sitting here in limbo. But I know it won't be long. Sitting here in limbo, like a bird without a song. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my faith
will be. Welcome to the Voices of Windrush with me, Sinai Flary, and my co-host, Patrick Vernon, OBE. On today's show, we will be speaking to Anthony Bryan, a Windrush survivor. He's here today to discuss why he decided to turn his story into the TV drama Sitting in Limbo, which was written by his brother, Stephen S. Thompson.
Colourful Sinai and Patrick on Colourful Radio.
Firstly, Anthony, we first had the pleasure of meeting you last year where you came into Colourful Radio to tell us about your story. How are you doing since we last spoke?
Well, health-wise, I'm good. Fighting the thing what they've prescribed for the smoking, the CPD. So that's why I can't go out to work at the moment. But I'm good.
Okay. Now we know why we're here to have this conversation with you. You decided to have your story, your Windrush story, told on the small screen. Can you tell us a little bit what made you decide to tell your story and have it made into a TV drama?
Well, the thing I was going through, most of my friends was going through it, so I wanted people to know because nobody knew what we were going through. Like, everybody was wondering, it's my fault, and nobody knew what was going on. So it was good to tell my story. Plus, it was made easier. Being my brother was a writer and things, so I told it to him, and we decided, so yeah, it was really good to get the story out there.
I was going to say, I did manage to sort of get a sneak peek of the film, and I must say it is very, very fantastic to watch, but also very hard. It's got some hard-hitting moments in there, and I did tear up, especially at the part where, you know, you kept being detained by the Homer.
That was a hard part in it. Because yeah. I'm not used to being locked up. So that was when, because I saw from a thing where I don't mind if I lock the room and go in there, but if somebody else lock it, it's like it's a trauma for me to want to get out. And I felt the anxiety when I went to, and then locked me up in the Verne. But the Verne was the hardest one for me anyway, because they practically broke me in the Verne, because I had signed to go back to Jamaica. I don't know if you know, but I signed in the event to go back because that was the only way I could come out, you know?
I have watched it back.
They sent me a link to watch it online. I watched it. I like it. I like the way they done. I like the story of how my brother portrayed it. And I like how the director bring it over. It was good. I didn't have no problem with it at all.
Okay, now you've mentioned your brother there. I want to bring him into the conversation. Stephen, this is your first screenplay for TV. What was it about your brother's story that made you decide to create this TV drama? And talk us through, how long did it take to write the entire thing from beginning to end?
When I first talked to Flower about it, Flower, you probably hear me say that a lot, that's our nickname for him, so don't, it's just a substitute for Anthony. So yeah, Flower and I discussed it in his yard one time as a book, and obviously, you know, that's my sort of day job, that's what I am, I'm mainly known for. But we were talking about it as a piece of non-fiction, and when we started discussing it, I realized that, you know, it's the sort of story that needs as big an audience as possible. So, you know, with the best will in the world, you know, it's very difficult for books to reach the level of, to have the reach of a TV program or a film. So I did talk to my publisher about it. And the other problem that we had at that time was that there were quite a few things that had been written about it already, either in the newspapers or there had been a documentary on TV. And there's been quite a few things on radio. So the story was sort of out there already in nonfiction form. So then I spoke to my film agent, and he suggested, you know, well, what about maybe possibility to turn it into a drama? So at that point, I had to pause because, you know, it means that you're taking someone's real life experience and essentially turn it into fiction. But once we started to discuss it, I said, well, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. There have been precedents for this sort of thing. If you think about this, if you think about the Stephen Lawrence story, for instance, which just turned into a sort of docudrama, that's what we initially thought about doing. So once we started, once we opened that Pandora's box, it was actually quite quick after that. It was just a question of getting people interested. And on side, I had to swear Flower and Janet to secrecy, because the problem is there would have been a lot of other people out there trying to do similar things. In fact, I'm sure they were approached by other people, if memory serves me correctly. But the Bee were very encouraging. And so, you know, we just had to basically make sure that we moved quickly. And of course, Flower wanted me to do it because, as you said just now, you know, it's a no-brainer, really, because even though I wasn't, you know, on the front line with him while he was going through all this stuff, I was sort of there in the background. I was aware of what was happening. And of course, once it became a sort of national news story and everyone knew what was going on, I thought, well, if it's okay with you, you know, let's just proceed. And he was quite happy about it. And both him and Janet came on board as consultants. So that was in 2016. I think that might have been in late 2018. And then by 2019, we got commissioned by Lucy to write the script. So it's quite a quick turnaround. We finished shooting in December of last year.
Okay. And how did you go about casting the actors and actresses for all these roles?
Well, they hire a casting director to do that job. Obviously, they consulted with Flower and Janet because they wanted to. You know, you can't mimic the real people. You don't want to. It's not an impersonation contest. But you want to try and find a way to bring the essence of their characters across on the screen. So the auditions were extensive. I didn't sit in on them. I was, you know, because I live in Southampton, if you know that, but most of these auditions took place in London. But they sent me through a few things so I can kind of review them and have an input. And it was a strange experience for me because I've never been in that situation before, to see these actors coming in and speaking lines that you've written, pretending to be your brother. I mean, it's, you know, the whole thing is absurd, really. But yeah, I think we took about maybe 3 or 4 weeks to finally cast the whole film. The principals were cast quite quickly, Patrick and Nadine. And then after that was a question of moving outwards to find any others.
Yeah. Okay. I want to just go back to Anthony. Anthony, were you happy with, you know, how you were portrayed in the film?
Oh, I was. To be honest, I was. The only thing I was disappointed in is because my brother Ford, actually, he knows I'm a Liverpool supporter, and in the film, I'm a Liverpool supporter. That's the only thing. I'm Liverpool from 9 years old. I should be a Liverpool supporter from 9 years old.
I don't know how any member of my family became Liverpool supporter, so I was correct.
No, but he's just Spurs supporter, so I understand he has to get Spurs in this summer. that was the only thing on my part, actually, you know?
Yeah.
I'll take that as the only criticism.
I mean, I know when I watched it, at one point I was thinking, this guy's got Anthony spot on.
Yeah, to be honest, there's some time I'm watching it, I'm thinking, well, that's me there. I mean, that was me there. That's the actor. He did look like me sometimes, I have to admit. I was second looking and third looking. And even the way I do something, it looked like me. It was good. I have to admit, it was good. I liked it.
That's good to hear. You get to see it on June 8th at 8:30 on BBC One, so everybody can sort of watch it.
That's the next thing. Was everybody's going to see it and then come back and say, I saw your story and the guy didn't like you, and no one's going to come back. So I'm getting that already at the moment.
Are you worried about what the public might might think of you after watching the film, or you don't, you know?
No, because I didn't do anything drastic to be worried about, but I would be ashamed of it. It was just funny seeing my story up there. That's the only thing. People, everyone's going, oh, some bad shit you've been going through. But other than that, I'm good. I'm good with it.
Yeah. I mean, what advice would you give to other people and families who are still going through their own Windrush scandal right now? As somebody who's been through it, you know, and seen firsthand, you know, the brutality of the Home Office and what they do to people, what advice can you share to try and help somebody else out there?
Well, it's hard to say, because some people, they ain't got no, some of the people then was out there still, they ain't got no paperwork, so it's hard to say to them. Listen to what I'm saying, because I won't listen to people as well, because it's frightening. Because once you go in the system and they're locking you up and telling you, say, yes, they're going to deport you. If you ain't got nobody outside fighting with you, well, you're going to any country where they decide to bring you to. You know? And that was the scary part of it. Once you're in the system, that's it. You know?
Yeah.
You can't fight outside and inside when you're locked up. And unfortunately, most of these people where I met, they ain't got no money. Everybody in there is broke, skin. And you can't work. So I don't see how you could pay your way. Most of them people is going to be deported either way, look at it or not, because they ain't got the resources to fight it.
I mean, I don't know if, I think, yeah, Clara's right about, like, sorry, yeah, it's hard when you're in the, if you're like the eye of the storm. I mean, the organisation that's been helping Flora and Janet with their compensation and what have you, they're quite a good place to start if people are looking for advice. Mm-hmm. I think they're called, aren't they called the North Kensington Law Practice or Law Centre, something like that. Mm-hmm. And in actual fact, one of the things that the film will do at the end of the film, there will be a list of organisations that people who are affected by the issues can contact.
That's really great. Because I think there's a lot of people out there who probably still haven't come forward, and I feel like this film might prompt them to do so.
Yeah, I think so too.
Well, I hope so as well.
Yeah. I mean, I know the government's launched a compensation scheme, and that's come under great criticism as well. I wanted to ask you, Anthony, you know, without discussing, you know, too much information, have they been in touch with you at all?
Yes, they have, but only lately. The 29th of last month.
Right, okay. Yeah. That's very recent. Do you think it's probably because this film is going to come out soon?
Well, I thought it was very strange the week the movie's going to come out, I get a letter from immigration saying that on compensation when I couldn't get nothing from them before.
Can I answer that?
Yeah, you can answer that.
Can I answer that?
Please do come in, Janet. Please do.
Yeah. What they've done, they've offered us an interim payment for his detention. That's the only thing they've offered. But we've been trying to get interim payment since day one, and we couldn't get it. And then all of a sudden, they've sent a letter out dated the 29th offering us a sum of interim payment.
Wow. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a coincidence to me.
Yeah.
And I'll just add as well that, Flower only told me about that. I think it was on the day. Flower told me on the day, and then I was talking to the production company and the BBC, because of course one of the things that we wanted to do in the film was to say that as of date, Anthony has not been compensated. So once the BBC launched its transmission date, which is on Monday, as you just mentioned, that then became public. And so somehow, I think, and that was well before the letter arrived. So then, it just seems too coincidental that once that went public, things just kind of sped up. Anyway, but you'll never know for sure, but it happened within that small window.
Yeah. I wanted to bring in Janet as well for the conversation. I wanted to ask her, what was it like seeing, you know, your husband go through having his nationality questioned and being detained by immigration officials? In the film, we see you're portrayed as very strong and very supportive. I want to hear from you, like, what was it like? What kept you going?
Oh, I don't even know what kept me going. I think work kept me going, quite honestly, being in work, because being indoors, you've got more time to worry about it. And then I had support from the family, like his sons and friends. So that literally kept me going. But it was hard and depressing. And especially if you speak to him and he sounds depressed, it was even worse. So at one stage, you could hear where he was like a bit more bubbly than depressive in his conversation. Then I started to relax a bit more because I think he met someone while he was in there that started to like cook and talk to him. And that same person actually told him what was on his paperwork, which was all wrong. So yeah, that was, it was hard. It was really, really hard.
Yeah. I take it you've seen the film, Janet.
What do I think of it? I think it's brilliant. I think they've got it to a T.
As Anthony's wife and you know, friend and supporter and mother of his children, what advice would you give wives and families?
No.
I'm just something wrong?
Yeah, I'm his partner. I'm not his mother. Oh, it's okay. I'm his partner.
His partner. My apologies.
That's fine.
What advice would you give to other family members who are going through their own Windrush scandal right now? How can they support, you know, their family members?
Do you know what? I would just tell them to try their best to keep strong and actually see what helps out there. Like Stephen said, you're going to get all the edits at the end to tell you what to do. But that's what I try and do now if anybody calls me or I've been on the road in a shop and someone's asked me. So since this has happened before the film, I've literally helped two people to actually get their documents.
Really?
For their mothers. Like two women, one at work and one I met in Asda.
Wow. See, that's the power of going through something. You're able to help other people. And I seriously thank you for doing so.
Because
there just doesn't seem to be enough information out there for our community to get help on this issue.
Yeah, but once you've gone through it, you can advise, I think. Because I know what I did and what I shouldn't do.
You can only know when you go through it.
Yeah.
If you don't know, you go from pillar to post. One person send you from here to there. If you don't know where to go first.
Absolutely. Now, Anthony, what are your hopes for the future for yourself?
Well, to be honest, I'm just hoping that I live a long life and I'm just trying to be happy. You know, because there's nothing else you can do at this present time. I'm still in limbo. I'm still in limbo at the moment. I don't know what was right. To be honest, my missus is directing me at the moment. I'm letting she take the reins for now.
And Janet, you're happy to do that?
I'm not a problem.
Well, we know Anthony's in good hands with you, you know. I wish you both all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right. I just want to go back to Stephen before we go. What do you hope the film will achieve and what's the main takeaway point you want viewers to remember after they finish watching Sitting in Limbo?
The main takeaway, well, probably that this story is ongoing. Unfinished. As those guys were saying just now, you know, there are a lot of people still caught up in the system and obviously the compensation issue is still to be resolved. So maybe that will concentrate minds in the corridors of power and get them to pull their finger out. And then the other thing, of course, is to remember that, you know, this happened on the Ra watch. You know, those arguments about British identity and British nationality and citizenship, we thought we'd settle those arguments back in the 70s and 80s as black people. So, you know, I just hope that, you know, it's on BBC, so BBC One, so it's going out mainstream to the whole country and internationally. And I just want, you know, ordinary, decent Brits to watch it and go, we should never allow that to happen. And we should be ashamed of ourselves and it shouldn't happen again. So those are probably the two main takeaways.
Yeah. Have you got any plans to do any more TV dramas? Because I couldn't believe this was your first one, actually, because it was excellent. I was gripped.
Oh, it was.
I was absolutely gripped. So have you got plans to do
any more? Yeah. I mean, we the producers and I are talking about doing other things. What I want to do is I want to try and put black stories on the screen. And, you know, that's a struggle. You know, it's so difficult. It's difficult to put those in books, never mind get them on the screen. So everything, you know, this is a story that was urgent and needed to be told quite quickly. But to get our stories away are always a challenge. So as much as you're hopeful and you have belief in what you're doing and belief in the people that you're working with, you're always having to convince other people. And it's such a long, long road. But that's the hope. And I was writing screenplays before this. You know, I've got 2 or 3 feature films in my drawer. And one of which is about the ongoing scourge of gun and knife crime amongst young black boys. Those are the kind of stories I want to be able to get away, you know, but viewed from a different perspective, from the perspective of the parents or the loved ones who are left behind. Those type of narratives.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to give 2 tips to up-and-coming screenwriters, I mean, what would those 2 tips be?
Well, I think generally speaking, you know, if you're into movies and TV dramas, then the first thing is, I say this to my students in the context of creative writing or in the context of writing books, reading and writing go hand in hand. So if you're going to write, you have to always be reading as well. And I would say the same is true for films and TV. You know, it's just a way of studying the craft and to know what's being made. And you get a kind of facility for it. You get a feel for the language, is the kind of grammar and syntax of TV writing that you need to kind of be aware of. You have to work extremely hard, harder than you probably ever worked on anything before. As I said before, that industry is a very tough one to crack. And learn your craft by writing. So just keep writing scripts until you get better at it, proficient at it.
Okay, thank you. And Anthony and Janet, before you go, have you got any lasting words you want to share with the listeners about your whole experience and also the film Sitting in Limbo?
Well, with the film Sitting in Limbo, I think it's good. I just think it's come at the time where everyone's demonstrating about Black Lives Matters as well. So
I think
it's going to cause a bit more uproar than it would as well, with that in mind, you know. Yeah. So it's at that time. But
it's funny.
I just think the film was really good. And like you said, Patrick mannerisms for Anthony was brilliant. Nadine was good.
I love the thing about the movie.
Yeah.
And particular likewise about me as well. I loved it more because it's telling the story of me. And I hope people see and learn from what I was going through.
Yeah. I'm sure that will happen.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, this and the opportunity to have the chance for you guys to revisit it, Colourful Radio, to come back and catch up with Anthony. You know, these are the sort of things that we, you know, we've got to look after our own, because, you know, the mainstream media, once they've gone away, the interest dies. So, you know, we need outlets like you guys to just, you know, just to give us the chance to sort of remind people that we're still here and the saga continues. So thanks for that.
And not being biased, I think Stephen deserves some form of award, maybe a BAFTA.
I'll take that.
Well, we'll be keeping posted of when we can start nominating for next year.
I'll
get everyone to nominate that hasn't.
I won't say that none that.
if bias was anything to go by, I'd be walking off with all of them.
It has been absolutely wonderful speaking to you all, and Anthony, it's been really great to catch up with you and see and
Thank
hear
you.
How you're doing. And I'm so pleased that, you know, you've managed to get your story out there in the form of this film with the help of your brother and of course with the support of Janet. I wish you all the best from myself and everybody here at Colourful Radio. Thank you for speaking to me today.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
Colourful Sinai and Patrick on Colourful Radio.
Joining us now on the Voices of Windrush is Windrush survivor Glenda Caesar and lawyer Jacqueline McKenzie.
So welcome to Colourful Radio, Voices of Windrush again, Jackie. We're on the show quite a few times over the last year, 18 months.
Yes, well, yes, and thank you for having me, and thank you for keeping these issues in the public consciousness. It's very important that we do that. There's so many competing issues at the moment, and quite rightly so, that some of them are, you know, trending, COVID-19, the awful stuff going on in America, particularly as a result of the death of, you know, George Floyd, but we need to keep Windrush alive in people's minds.
And that's why we're here. So 2 years on from the Windrush scandal, and about probably 14 months on since the launch of the Windrush Compensation Scheme. It was just announced just over a week ago now that £360,000 has been awarded by the Home Office for 60 cases. What is your take on that? And what more can be done in terms of demanding compensation, particularly for those people who have not come forward yet?
Yes, the figures that were released recently in terms of Windrush compensation are extremely disappointing. I think there are a number of reasons for this. But partly, I think the numbers are going to be low anyway, because a lot of people, what we have is a compensation scheme that compensates people for losses that they can demonstrate. And a lot of people are not going to be able to demonstrate loss. I mean, our people are very resilient people. And if they lost a job because they didn't have immigration documents, they found another job where perhaps immigration documents weren't required in the same way. So I think the numbers overall, because of the way the scheme is designed, are going to be low in terms of the numbers of people applying. They're also going to be low in terms of the amount people get because the tariffs are low and the evidential requirements are high. You know, people actually have to prove things. They don't, you know, the government said that there'd be a light touch approach, but that isn't the case. So, for instance, I've seen the case of a woman who was wrongly removed to Grenada. She was one of the first people to put her Windrush application, compensation application in, and she still has not to this day had an offer. And what she gets instead is numerous requests for further information, which I think is completely unconscionable. It's untenable where she's concerned because she can't provide all of it. And this woman was wronged. She's somebody who actually provided 75 pieces of evidence to show that she had the right to be in the UK and that she'd been in the UK since the 1960s. And she was still asked to leave at Christmas 2016. So it's hugely, hugely problematic. But the third reason why this is problematic and why the numbers are going to be low is because there is no professional support available that's funded or supported by government to help people make claims. So people are having a go themselves, or they're going to the CA service, or they're going to lawyers who want to charge 30% compensation, 30% of the compensation. And so, you know, so people are taking their cases back from them. And then there are people like us who are trying to do something, but the job is a difficult job. So I'm working on a whole series of compensation claims, and you have, they're nuanced. It isn't just, you can't just look at the scheme. You've got to look around the scheme. You've got to work with people. There's a lot of vulnerability in the community. There's educational issues, there's mental health issues, there's complex multiple needs issues like homelessness, for instance. You can't say to somebody, just go and get your evidence. You've got to help them to get it. You've got to write off to HMRC, DWP for benefits records, national insurance records, and then auto employers, auto banks, or to doctors, or you've got to get them to go and see a doctor. It's a proper claims job. And then you've got to try and put a claim together within the law. So, you know, there's several pieces of legislation, immigration legislation, there's rules and policies, and the claim has to fit within there. And then you've got to be creative in how you maximize that claim and how you evidence it. So it's not straightforward, and I think that's the main reason why the numbers are low, partly because they will be low, because not a lot of people will be entitled to claim. There is nowhere in this scheme, and I'll finish at this point, there's nowhere in this scheme where there's a sum of money that just says, look, you've been messed about, you've been treated really badly, your rights have been stripped from you, here is a sum of money. It isn't that scheme. It's a scheme that compensates you for demonstrable loss.
So, as you know, we've had Martin Ford QC, who advised the Home Office on the scheme. He's been on the show quite a few times, and he said that the scheme was meant to be easy, accessible, but the way that you've described it, it seems to be the opposite.
Yes. So, in terms of what the scheme means and the form itself, I would say that those two things are easy. I'm not saying they're adequate, because I still have an issue with the tariffs being quite low, but that's just
one thing. Here is a scheme. Do you fit into it? That's quite straightforward. So I think that's what he means when he says it's easy. And the form itself, you know, name, address, what have you lost here? What is quite easy. But that's not the job. The job is to put that aside and think about how have you suffered? What have you lost? How am I going to evidence this? How am I going to substantiate things? How am I going to maximize my claim because I have really suffered? And what can I adduce to back up whatever I'm saying? How do I fit within the law? Where are the comparative cases from litigation that will help me? All of that is not easy whatsoever.
At this stage, I'd like to bring in Glenda. Hi there, Glenda.
Hi.
You are a survivor of the Windrush scandal. Do you want to explain briefly to our listeners your circumstances? And I know that you've also tried to apply through the compensation scheme too.
Yeah, my circumstances was back in 98 where I found out that I actually wasn't British or a citizen of Britain, even though I'd been working here, I've got four adult children, had done over 20-odd years service with NHS and administration and positions. In 2009, I was applied for a part-time job as a GP administrator, and it was there where they asked me for my passport. I'd never been asked for a passport before, even though I had made applications for a British passport and was turned down, so I had to make do with a Dominican passport where I was born. I've been in this country since I was 6 months old. I came here as a baby with relatives. In 2009, when I was asked to produce a passport, I was like, well, I haven't got a British passport, but I have got a long history of working within the NHS. That wasn't good enough, so they terminated me from my position as gross misconduct, because I couldn't show the ability to show that I had a permit to work in England. It took off in 2000. I just said, you know what, I'll just try and do what I did. Within that time, I tried to accumulate all paperwork because I was just reading everything on the gov.gov.uk web page to see what would help me, to assist me to get some way of regulating my status to say, look, I am actually British. So I sent off all the documentation, like what Jackie had mentioned. I writ to the HMRC, I writ to the Department of Work and Pension, because they've got everything on me. I even tried to get records, my medical records, which I couldn't find. Then they wanted information on my father. There was nothing on my father, even though my father was a home. He bought a house in England and he worked in England. And he came here before I was, before me. He came here first to bring me and my mum over. But it just got worse and worse until in 2000, I think it was 18, that I got approached by media and they asked if I would tell my story. I said, yes, I would, because I wanted people to know what I was going through. Unbeknown to me, I didn't realize there was other people who were going through the same thing, and people who I had known and had grown up with. I didn't realize that this was happening to them. But then it all came to light. Once it did come to light, it was a matter of the Home Office were very quick. Within 7 days, I had been told I'm a British citizen. And within that 7 days, because my youngest son was born in 1988, when I was confronted at the Home Office, I spoke to three senior officers there, and they would ask me a question, what would you... Mrs. Caesar, is anything you would like to ask us? And I said, what's the implication on the children born in 1988? And they straight away answered me with, oh no, mentioning my son's name, he's got his citizenship. And that broke me, because that was my fight all along. I could have given up, but knowing he was born in this country and he didn't have the right to say he was British and they wouldn't allow him a British passport, that's what hurt me. But now, by the grace of God, they've given us both our citizenship. Now, in relation to the compensation, that's another story, because we were told before it even came out, we was asked to provide evidence, which I did, and I sent it off via email. Every paperwork, I scanned it and I sent it through to them. But they then they came out with the form. Now, in relation to the form, I completed the form myself, because we was told that it was very simple, just put in your information, just get it down, you know, it's on a first come, first served basis, and you would get the compensation, they'd work it out. thinking, okay, provide everything, which I did. Payslips, P60s, the letter of me being terminated, I provided everything. But that was, as far as they were concerned, that wasn't good enough. When they did offer me the compensation, which was last year, I think it was November, and I saw the letter and it said £22,664. I was like, no, this is a joke, because £7,000 for impact on life, £1,500 for being detained in the airport, and I think the rest was £13,000 they were offering me for loss of employment. And I was like, no, this is a joke, because I was earning a lot more than that, even though it was on a part-time basis. And I, even if I was claiming benefits, it doesn't accumulate for 10 years, 13,000. So I rejected it. And
Glenn,
I was like,
you,
no.
You were interviewed on Channel 4, and what was the expression that you used which went kind of viral?
I basically said it's breadcrumbs for peasants. We're not peasants. You cannot throw breadcrumbs at us. You know, we're hungry. Of course we're hungry. But we were put in this position because the government put us in this position. I was quite happy working, and like a lot more other people, we were quite happy living our daily lives. So how can you expect to just throw things, you know, throw breadcrumbs out and say, well, you've got to take that because we said you've got to take it. No, you were wrong. You have to validate us because you are the ones who made the mistake. And right now, rejecting it, I'm still waiting for me to get compensation. So even seeing the number that came out, I was like, well, we haven't been paid. So where did you get that from?
So for the record and for our listeners, despite the fact that you were covered quite heavily in the national media early on this year, I know that there've been lots of conversations. You've not received a new offer as of yet. Is that correct?
Nope. That's right. Nope, I haven't. I'm still fighting on Twitter. I've asked Priti Patel to sit with me and explain to me on Twitter. I'm on social media because someone has to answer. I don't feel that the government has actually sat down with any real victim of this scandal and listened to what we want, what we need, what we're asking you for. They're just making their own decisions and hoping that we will compile. No, we will not. No, no.
Do you believe that because you said you rejected the offer, because obviously a lot of people have accepted the offers, and there have been some calculations that the average claim is about £4,000. Do you think some people have said, you know what, it's just too much, I'll just accept the money? Do you think that has happened to people that you know or you've heard about?
Well, I believe, I haven't heard it, but I believe that some people may have just said, you know what, I'm giving up, I can't be bothered, just give it to me so I can just try and rebuild my life. I did have a lady who called me up, and she had told me that they had given her an offer, and she was like, well, I don't know what to do. Do I just accept it? I said, no, you've got to fight this, fight them, because that's not enough. But she was like, oh, I just can't be bothered no more. I'm just going to turn around and say to them, no, I'm going to accept it. I'm like, no, you earn a lot more than that. You cannot just accept it. But this is what you're going to find in our communities, that sometimes we just say, oh, I'm going to give up. I just can't be bothered because it's going to be a long wait, a long haul. I spoke to someone yesterday, and I actually, they're in arrears. And I said to them, well, call the vulnerable unit and, you know, task force and let them know. And they're like, no, because I ain't heard anybody else who's actually got the most. I just can't be bothered. And I'm thinking, well, it's there for you to claim. You have to claim it. But I, for one, will not give up. I want to see what they're going to, whatever they offer me, then it will most probably let people know, yes, come forward now. And I'm determined to keep fighting until they do the right thing. And I will not stop.
That's great. Mm. On that note, Jackie,
yes.
you're aware of this of Clint Gunn's case.
Yes.
Obviously, you're involved in lots of other cases. And the question, I think a lot of our listeners are saying, well, hold on here. Is this scheme's not working for people? It seems to be designing people out not to claim.
Yes, I mean, so the scheme as it's designed is one thing, but the processing is the problem. The processing is definitely not working for people. I mean, Glenda's story is heartbreaking. I'm so delighted to hear that she's going to continue to fight. I mean, I as you know, or some of you may well know, that I do a lot of surgeries all over the place, but particularly at the Black Cultural Archive, and mainly through Patrick Vernon, actually. He set this up. And one of the things we get there is people who've already put their forms in. People have done their own claims. And I had a woman who lost her job in her 60s and was offered £12,000 compensation. Yep. And she was only a part-time worker, low pay, so she was only on £6,000 a year, but that accounted for 2 years worth of her loss of earnings. And I said, well, what about your future loss of earnings? Because it's not going to be that easy to get a job at that age again. So they should be paying up to retirement. And so I've done an appeal for her, a tier one review, and I've submitted that. And after about 2 weeks, she rang me and said, well, what's happening? She's not heard anything from them. Other than an acknowledgement, and she was ready to withdraw because she needs the money. People need the money. And she was ready to sign on the dotted line to accept the 12,000. And it's very difficult to say to people, don't you dare do that. You know, this is an insult to you. In the end, they agreed to give her some money up front out of the 12,000 so she can get, you know, she was living without a cooker. And she just got a new property that the council had housed her. And so they've agreed to give her some money. And I don't know, I mean, that was meant to be this week, but so I don't know if she's received it yet, but everything is so slow. And one of the things that really irritates me is when the scandal first broke, I actually met one of the very senior people in the Home Office, the Director General, Glyn Williams, and he actually sort of showed me, whilst going to his office, he showed me floors, you know, open plan office with reams of people who he said he'd put together to specifically work on Windrush. And that was Luna House, that was Marsham Street, the head office of the Home Office. And as I understand it, I mean, I saw one floor, I understood there were other floors, but there were also people in Luna House in Croydon. There were people in Liverpool. I mean, there are hundreds of people working on, what are they doing? Because there's been no changes on the policy. And the numbers of people affected by the Windrush scandal are much lower than we thought, and that's mainly because people are coming forward because people are still scared, or they think, well, I've lived all my life without this, I don't really want the hassle of it now. The compensation claims are going to be low for the reasons I said previously. And so, you know, why can't you be more effective and more efficient in dealing with this? I just don't understand. And for me now, the problems, I mean, I've got issues that I've raised previously about the scheme and the tariffs and why aren't people just being compensated, you know, as you give them some money to say sorry for the way they've been treated, why isn't that in the scheme? I put all of that aside now, because you can make the scheme work for you, but what is not working is the processing. The processing is abysmal.
Mm-hmm. As you know, Jackie and Glenda, I launched a campaign compensation scheme should be moved away from the Home Office to another government department or agency. And there are lots of examples where government has given compensation schemes and redress schemes to organisations that know how to do that. I think the Home Office is not competent and has the inclination. And hearing Glenda's story and the stuff that you're dealing with, I know that you've got hundreds of cases, Jackie. I mean, it makes the case. So what needs to happen to change that? And moving forward, if there are listeners who want to claim, what is the best way to go around that?
Yes, well, I think, I mean, another government department, I think there's something, well, we saw with the Windrush Lessons Learned review where, you know, Wendy Williams, a civil servant herself, talks about the serious harm caused by this government. And she talks about the requirements for cultural changes and cultural shifts within the paradigm of the Home Office. But I think that's throughout government. I think we will find that throughout government. If the scheme, it's either that the government start taking the Windrush issue more seriously, and the teams brought in to work on them start understanding the nature of the issue and the cohort that they're working with and the support that they need, and start, you know, doing that properly, or they give it out to an organisation. And you're absolutely right. I mean, there's lots of examples of this. Grenfell, Hillsborough, Lambeth Council, Shirley Oaks scheme. None of these are being administered by legal panels, or, you know, with people being able to choose their own representatives. I mean, the Home Office are the aggressor, and they're the ones they're the defendant in this case, if you put it in the vernacular, and yet they're administering their own, you know, defense. I mean, it's just, it's appalling. And at first, we were all prepared to give them the time to do it. That's what exists, and we thought we could work with them. But I'm not necessarily seeing much to be heartened about. I think one of the High Commissioners said to me, you know, when we were dealing with a case of a woman who'd been turned down for vulnerable persons payment and told, well, why don't you just put a compensation claim in and wait? And we realized then that, you know, these people, they are treating our community with contempt. I don't think any other community would be treated this way. And it is probably the case that it shouldn't have been the Home Office, particularly with the Vulnerable Persons Unit. It should not have been. People brought back to the country, like people like Joycelyn John and Vernon Van Riel, who've been given the absolute runaround by the Vulnerable Persons team. The Vulnerable Persons team is part of the Home Office. They should have no business in this. You have messed up these people's lives. It should have been another organisation that receive people when they come back to the UK, make sure that they get, I mean, Chipperin Burton was another one. Yeah. You know, she asked for £500 for warm clothing, and somebody at the Vulnerable Persons team wrote to her and asked her, what do you mean by warm clothing? This is a woman who'd been stuck in Jamaica for 13 years, came back in December, you know, one of the coldest months of the year, and was asked by somebody who was only being facetious, because that cannot be a genuine question. You know, she was being facetious and undermining of a Windrush victim. It is absolutely appalling, and I think it is absolutely correct that issues like that should not have been dealt with by the Home Office. In terms of the bigger scheme, I think that there are people there who can do this. I've seen a commitment for some of the people at the top end to try and resolve this. I've even heard the commitment from the Home Secretary herself, but it's not working. And if it doesn't, if it continues like this much longer, I think there does need to be a clarion call for it to be taken away from them and given to an organisation who can do it.
So, Glenda, what's your take on this?
I agree 100% with what Jackie said, because what you're finding is that these people who are dealing with the cases, they have no empathy towards what we've gone through, what we're going through. We're not begging you. We're asking you for what is ours. Many people who have even tried to get onto receiving benefits, and now some are being told, well, you haven't contributed in the last 2 years, so you can't claim this. And you're like, well, I wasn't able to contribute because the government stopped me. So something's going wrong somewhere. We need people who are going to listen to us and understand what we are going through and realize that we did not put ourselves in this position. We were put into this position. But like Jackie turned around and she just said, you will get people like saying, well, you have to take that. No, you can't, you're not entitled to this. But I am entitled to it. And another thing what I find is that a lot of us that was working, we contributed national insurance contributions, and we're not even able to access that also. And so as well as losing out on contributions and losing out on wages, we can't even get the compensation that we're entitled to. So maybe, I don't know, maybe they need to look at their workers and put them through some sort of training or give it to someone who can cope with it. That's what we need.
So one of the key things, as you know, there are lots of Windrush organisations around the country. Some of them have formed action groups. Some of them have done legal advice surgeries. Some of them are doing direct action, a whole variety of things. If this level of injustice is happening 2 years on since the Windrush scandal, we're not even touched on the issue around deportation. We're not even touched on the issue around those people have not come forward to stop to have their status regularised. What's happened with the community? There should be, why aren't people fired up by this? I know you're both fired up by this. I'm fired up by this. So Senai, that's why we're here. But why isn't there a sense of a degree of urgency in the community to do this? If you compare what's happened around the coronavirus pandemic situation, I mean, just one element of that, within the last 7 weeks, the government has pushed through the door billions of pounds. One in five people in Britain have been furloughed. They've given lots of money to a whole range of organisations, but yet in 14 months, they've only given less than £400,000. Why is the anger of the community fired up by this? Jackie?
Yes, no, 100%. I've just been having this discussion over the past few days because I've seen The way the community can react, as we've seen with the Black Lives Movement matter, response to, you know, the killing of George Floyd. We can mobilise. I do think, though, that there is a lack of leadership in our community. Yes. And where we have got some people who can do things and raise their voices, it's very piecemeal. So there's an issue, they'll put out a statement or they'll go on a march, but there's no real work being done in between. There are no real structures or organisations or movements backed with money or resources to get workers in to do the work. This is a job that needs to be done. And the Home Office, I'm absolutely certain, look at us and say, oh, yeah, you know, this is a little old ladies, you know, came on these boats and, you know, who's going to stand up for them? And I think they're shocked that even some of us are still around making noise. They probably think, oh, that loudmouth Jackie McKenzie's still going. you know, they probably thought I shut up a long time ago. Because we're not well represented. It is something we've got to address. And it's got to be addressed within the context of all sorts of things going on in our society, police brutality, problems in the criminal justice system, school exclusion. We're going to go into a really dreadful recession, I would imagine, unless some miracle happens. And who's going to be the ones forced out of the jobs or lose their jobs are going to be, I think, mostly Black and minority ethnic workers, particularly people in low-paid jobs. So in terms of the community who are mostly affected by Windrush, and I know it's not exclusively, but mostly affected by, these are the same people who are mostly affected by everything else that's wrong with society. And it's time that we start to build the structures and organisations to represent our people. I don't think there's anything there. Now, in terms of the Windrush groups, there are, we've seen around the country, some really good people come together. You know, in the conurbations, we've seen this in Manchester, in the Midlands, in the Northwest, in Preston. You know, there's Luton, there's Oxford, there's little groups of people around London trying to do things. And so there are some really good people. But I have to say, one of the problems is that this is a job. And we need to build those structures, because what I have found is that those organizations don't have the capacity. Sometimes the issue is a lack of skills and knowledge and experience. Everyone's doing it in their spare time. You know, they've got other things to do, whether they're preaching or they're running some organization somewhere else, or got a, you know, they're a nurse or a lawyer or something. We are just not properly organized. And we're not properly represented. The government's seen this, and so they're taking the mickey, to use the vernacular again. And we can't represent our community properly through the current structures. And one of the things that needs to come out now, based on COVID-19, Windrush, and the awful racism that we're seeing on the rise across the globe, but we're focused on the US, but it's right here, needs to come out a way forward for how we become resilient, not just vocally and in writing. You know, we could all tweet and we could all do an opinion piece in one of the newspapers, but how do we build real structures that's going to force change? Because it's been 70 odd years that the main bulk of our community have been here, but we know there have been people here for hundreds of years before that. And look where we are today. We are at the bottom. And that's the only reason why people like Glenda Caesar and your Jocelyn Johns and your Chipperlyn Burtons and your Vernon Van Reels have not had a penny to this day, 2 years after that scandal and 2 years after Amber Rudd apologised in the House of Commons. It is an absolute disgrace. And we need to be able to respond to this much more effectively than we've been doing.
Glenda, what do you think the community should be doing? You've survived. You're a survivor of the system, and it's really great that you're still fighting. But what needs to happen so there's justice for you and the thousands of other people being caught up in the scandal?
Yeah, we do. We need a leader. We need someone who's going to stand up and speak for us on this this issue. And we do need to come together as one, to fight against the government on this issue and all the other issues that's affecting our community. But it's just one person we need. We need one person who's going to stand up in Parliament and say, listen, you have to do something about this. And that is what we need to unite, and we need a very strong leader.
Okay, so on that front, what advice would you give to anyone who's listened to the show how to get involved, either people who want to sort out their compensation scheme or their status, or just to get involved and hear the call that you've just been made? Jackie, what should people, where should people go?
There's good national reach, so it depends on where the person is. If they're in London, they should contact the Black Cultural Archives. They're really mobilising this level of work, and they work with my firm, but they also work with other firms and other organisations. So I'm not trying to promote myself. They do really cover quite a large, but I mean, in fact, they're national. We get people that come from all over the country, but they're in London. So if you're in London, they're the best place to contact. Some of the law centres are doing sterling work. And I know Glenda's worked with the Hackney Law Centre. I believe it's the Hackney Law Centre. Mm-hmm. They're a very good organisation. As I said, there are Windrush organisations around the country. If you just Google, you will pull up, you know, Manchester, Birmingham, Luton. You will pull them up. If you're, I mean, some of our people aren't on Twitter and those sorts of institutions. But if you are, and you just put Windrush in a search, you will find there's almost a Windrush group almost in every one of the major areas, including in some of the devolved authority areas, like there's one in Cardiff, I understand. I think it's in Bristol, but it covers Cardiff, maybe not in Scotland. But you can always find somebody. But as a last resort, I mean, even in the Black Cultural Archives, when we get the inquiries, they come through to Mackenzie Boter and Pope, my firm. And if we find that the person's in Manchester or Birmingham, we refer them to the organisations of the VAIR. Remember, this is all pro bono work. So there's no benefit in us hogging all the cases because we're not getting paid. So we're very happy to disperse. So if it's easier, because the Black Cultural Archive is a national body and everybody knows who they are, if it's easier to contact them in the first instance, do, and we will find you an organisation or some sort of structure, a lawyer or somebody who's doing pro bono work or charging a minimum fee who can assist you.
Right. And Glenda, what advice would you give to anyone who is either hasn't put in the claim, thinking about putting in the claim, or not quite sure what to do?
Like Jackie mentioned, if you have got access to Google, put in Windrush and you should be able to get the help. I'm open. I'm on every platform that there is. So if you're afraid to approach lawyers or solicitors because you think you're going to be charged, approach me. I will definitely put you in the right direction. Like Jack says, there's the Black Culture Archives, there's a group in Preston, there's a group in Oxford, there's different groups, so that we've got links with them, so we can always put you in the right direction. I'm on Twitter, Glenda Caesar at Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. Send me a message and I'll put you in the right direction. That's not a problem. I'll try to assist you in any way that I can. But put in your claim, no matter how small it is. You are going to need legal help. There's no doubt about that. You're definitely going to need legal help. And the government needs to put funding towards people like Jackie, who are helping the people, who are helping us with the issue that they brought up. So the government needs to send money so that we get legal assistance as well to complete this 18-page form and the 13-page form.
That's great. Just a final note. When we had the lockdown, Lessons Learnt Review report was published in Parliament, and Priti Patel did a statement. She also made an announcement that £500,000, what was called a grassroots fund, would be available for Windrush groups and organisations to apply. I think it's mainly based on the work of JCWI and the work I've been working with them around the Women's Justice Fund. But there seems to be another story with this, that this money now is going to be diverted elsewhere. Jackie, do you want to comment on this?
Yes. I mean, there was a meeting yesterday with the Home Secretary, and I got to the meeting. It was an online meeting, but I still got to it late, unfortunately, because I'd messed up the time. And so, I mean, I don't know if you were in the meeting, Glenda, and if you heard what
I'm not invited, Jackie. They won't have me on there. I think I'm too outspoken.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I thought you were involved. So it must have been the other Glenda, because there was, the names come up on Zoom, and yeah. I thought I saw your name. So 500,000 had been earmarked for grassroots fund for Windrush, and then we'd seen an email from Dan Hobbs at the Home Office to Dawn Hill at the Black Cultural Archives, which says and it was because he said in a public meeting on the 19th of May online that the meeting was being, that the money was going to now be used to look at wider issues that affect the black minority ethnic community, particularly arising out of things that are happening. So I asked Dawn to Ms. Hill to write to somebody at the Home Office, because we really do need that money to come to the community. It's peanuts. Mm-hmm. Not a penny has come in yet. Mm-hmm. And he wrote back and he confirmed that's the thinking. And I don't know what the outcome. I mean, in fact, I'm, at 1 o'clock, I'm going into a meeting with some of the people who are in that meeting. So we're going to be discussing this. But that was the it sounds as though that money, that they're thinking now. I think maybe our representations might mean that they then rethink. But absolutely certain that money was going to be taken away and shoved into a new advisory group that's going to be set up to look at wider issues affecting the BME community. And I would imagine that's as a result of things like how we've been disproportionately affected by COVID-19, etc. And so, again, you know, a diminution of our rights, and a diminution of how they perceive the Windrush issue. £500,000 is such a negligible sum of money when you think that for the EU Settled Status Scheme, they gave £9 million to 50 organisations to do their work. We've not had a penny. And whereas I was committed, absolutely, and I remain committed at the outset, to continue working for people without charging them, it is difficult. We need more help. And we cannot get more help unless we have some funding to pay people. I cannot ask people to come and work for me for free. So that's the big problem. And it's absolutely shocking that not only that the money was peanuts to start with, and to use Glenda's term, I'm going to use, I love that, of £500,000, but now they want to take it away. Absolutely disgraceful. We've got to stand up and speak out for ourselves and write and lobby. We just don't have that power. I don't know what happens. I mean, some of our politicians, you know, occasionally are helpful to us, and certainly I don't want to say that they've not been helpful on Windrush, because some of them have been, some haven't. But we've got elected representatives, and you know, are they even aware of this issue? But they should be, because we tweet about it, we talk about it, they all follow us. But we are, I have to say, and I feel awful to say it publicly, but I don't think we're well represented at all.
Definitely, we're not.
I think we still need, the saga still continues. We still need to fight for justice for
the women's
generation on all different fronts. And I want to thank you, for both of you, for your ongoing tenacity and leadership. Because I know you say that we need to have this kind of guru, this leader person, but we're all leaders in our own right.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to pull the leadership together in a group, basically. Maybe.
That's what I think, and a movement, a structured movement. We need a structured, because there is lots of good things around, but they're not effective because there isn't a structured organisation.
So I just want to thank both of you, Glenda Caesar, keep on fighting, keep on representing Hackney.
I will do.
And Jackie McKenzie, keep on representing the lawyers out there and community activists. And so thank you.
I'm not representing the lawyers, by the way. I'm representing the people who have been who have suffered at the hands of the state.
And doing a good job at it, Jackie.
Colourful Sinai and Patrick. Colourful Radio.